This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I thought I'd start with something amusing, and that is reactions that I've been exposed to coming out of China in recent days from party elites. And the reaction is, speaking to the liberal intellectuals in China, you see, you whiners, you want democracy? This is what happens. It's being said. It's being said. Okay. Given, if we think about the campaign and the phenomenon of bashing, it's hard to imagine a place that was that didn't get more bashing than China. China bashing. Let's start with that. Given the amount of China bashing in the campaign, are there going to be problems with respect to Sino-American relations? Big problems, major problems, catastrophic problems, all of the above. This is the big question. And, of course, I agree with all the speakers so far. It's far too early to know. And I'm going to make a few suggestions here. Economic problems, for example, Steph referred to the possibility there. Military encounters of one sort or another, those are all problems, potential problems. So the question is, how will Chinese citizens at all levels, from elite levels all the way down to the grassroots of society, how will they read things? And it's hard to say anything meaningful about the future of China or Sino-American relations in 8 minutes. So I think all I'll do is give you some context to think about what might unfold in the coming weeks and months and years. Some context might help. So experience, and I go to China a couple of times every year, and I've been doing that for as long as I can remember. Experience has taught me that when it comes to China, since the Communist Revolution of 1949, there's nothing more important than domestic politics. That's something you've got to know about, regardless of the moment. And this means conflict within the ruling Communist Party. Very important to understand this, not necessarily easy to get at. It was true in 1949, and it's true again today. Just open the newspapers, and you'll read about it on a regular basis. These days, this conflict is not about ideology. And by ideology, I mean communism. It is very hard to find anyone in China who takes communism or the hope of a communist future for China seriously. I find it very difficult to find such people, least of all in the Chinese Communist Party itself. So communist ideology as a motivating factor for citizens was abandoned a long time ago, the late 1970s, if not earlier. Since then, and this is what we need to know when we try to gauge the response of people in China to the election, since then, citizen consumption and the drive to achieve higher standards of material comfort has been sanctioned as the key motivator in citizens' lives. That's what you should be thinking about. That's what you ought to try to do. And in that sort of new rules of the game, there have been winners, there have been losers, and so forth. Some have argued that this has left what might be called a spiritual hollowness in China with the disappearance of ideological zeal. And some have even said it's left a rather hedonistic society, where it's all about moving up the ladder of consumption, and this determines the difference between good and successful people and losers. State leaders have tried to fill this spiritual void, and I think this is probably my main point. They tried to fill this spiritual void by doing whatever it takes to internalize strong nationalist consciousness in citizens in China. So I want to talk a bit about the current state of nationalism and nationalist consciousness in China. Many citizens, sometimes I'm surprised by the extent of it and the location of this kind of consciousness, many citizens buy into it, many do not. And it's interesting to talk to those people as well. And this will condition responses to almost anything, including the election. Trust us, leaders say. Follow us, they say. Our goal is to make China number one. And now we have some money to play with to do that. One way of looking at this is that it's 19th century social Darwinist logic. Even though we're supposed to be living in a globalized world, it's about nation states, loyalty to those nation states, nationalist consciousness, and the drive to be number one. This is something that is very, very powerful in China today. So I urge you in the coming days, weeks, months, years to pay close attention to the role and the function of Chinese nationalism. It's not going to go away very soon. And it's not that China doesn't have domestic problems. They have lots and lots of nagging domestic problems. Environmental degradation that is mind-boggling to imagine if you haven't actually experienced it in China. Corruption, top to bottom, inside, outside. Restless, to say the least, ethnic minorities. And the list goes on and on and on. So there's been obvious success. Again, all you have to do is look at the newspaper, New York Times. There's been obvious success on the economic development front, but there's also great pressure to keep growth rates up, and that's not going to be easy. So that is a problem. But the state leaders want to be seen by all citizens as the guardian of the nation in a dangerous world. And this thrust is linked to its own sense of legitimacy. That is to say, this is what we do, this is what we care about, this is what you ought to care about, and so listen to us. So how dangerous is the world? I mean, again, we're looking at perceptions that arise in China itself, at least in my experience over the years. How dangerous is the world? Just take a look at a map of China and try to identify the nations that share a border with China. We share a border with two countries, Canada, we've already been nicely represented, and Mexico, we've also heard about, and that's it. China fought, this is after 1949, China fought in Korea beginning in 1950. To put it mildly, tense relations 90 miles away with Taiwan, that's not going anywhere. Tense relations for lots of obvious reasons with Japan. Tense relations with North Korea, who would have thought? It's actually at a stage of being rather amusing if it wasn't so scary. China had a border war with the Soviet Union in 1969. Went to war with India in the early 1960s. Went to war with Vietnam in 1979. I remember being out by the Vietnam border of China that particular year, listening to the cannons exploding in the distance. China is bordered by various Islamic nations to the west, nations that care a lot about China's Muslims in Xinjiang and elsewhere. So this is what the map of China looks like, being surrounded, in effect, by nations and peoples with whom it's having difficulty. And so this is where the nationalism and the desire to build nationalist consciousness comes in. A friend of mine, Professor Chen Jian, who is a professor at Cornell University in the same field, modern Chinese history, he proclaimed in a lecture that I attended that the nationalism of Chinese leadership elites is nurtured by what he calls a profound victim complex. Think about that. Think about what that means. And he his attitude toward it was very, very critical, saying that this can take on very, very problematic dimensions. What does that mean? Victim complex. What does that mean at the highest levels of leadership? Well, it means we were pushed around in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and we're not going to get pushed around anymore. Hence, all of these border conflicts that I just referred to. In fact, we're going to do the pushing around because that's the measure of a great nation. Again, according to this social Darwinian kind of logic, it rallies citizens and generates national pride. That is to say, when you push others around, that, according to this logic, this generates national pride and rallies citizens. And, we should add, it distracts attention from domestic problems, another function of this kind of nationalism. That's why, so now I want to get to something that's happening right now, that's why the, what let's call them, the island disputes, offshore island disputes with Korea, with Japan, with the Philippines, don't be fooled by the recent trip of the new Philippine president to China, with Vietnam, are so dangerous, especially the artificial islands, the islands that are being constructed, complete with airports and so forth, and the territorial water rights that come with those declarations. So the likelihood, we should think about this, what's the likelihood of an incident occurring on this particular front linked to nationalist proclivities? The likelihood of an incident in that particular sphere, if we just want to look at what I'm calling the islands dispute, I would say the likelihood of an incident is great. One that could quickly escalate into ongoing military confrontation. I think to rule that out would be foolish. So it's really it's scary. It wouldn't take much. It wouldn't take much, and none of the parties involved will want to back down, and therefore look weak. So this is a consideration that we should think about when we go back to the discussions, the comments I made earlier about the bashing, the China bashing, that lots of charges and claims and threats were made. I worry about what may happen. And of course, not in the prediction business, but I think there's something serious there to worry about. And I just want to end by pointing to three things that I hope we talk about in the Q&A with respect to U.S.-China. One, let's call it global, and Steph already referred to it, the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership looks like it's up in smoke. Interesting to watch from here on what happens with respect to regional trade agreements. Who's doing what? Who's involved? Who's not involved? Non-trivial. Very, very important. What will the consequences be for the United States, for example, of not putting together or being involved in something like that? Again, we don't know, but it's a big question. It deals with economics. What about the United States broadly? One of the things I'm personally very interested in is what many have referred to as China's international soft power initiatives as a way to counter the image of domestic nationalism and ultranationalism, a much softer picture of China. That is a lot of money, let me put it that way, is being spent on, including in Hollywood. I mean, you can open up the New York Times and you'll read about China's exceedingly strong interest in Hollywood. And what that then means for relations as one country tries to present an image of itself and therefore gain influence in another country, recent purchase by China of the AMC chain nationwide. Interesting development. Again, we don't know in the next several months, years, how this will play out. The whole issue of information management, I think will be something I certainly want to watch. And then we can even, last, I would just want to say something about the local scene right here at UCSD. This is the flow of Chinese students to the United States. I learned the other day we have approximately 1,500 undergraduates from China on the UCSD campus. I just gave some lectures at Columbia University, also very significant numbers, and up and down the UC system and so forth. And I noticed one of the threats in the aftermath of the election was Chinese government saying, be careful what you do. We may stop the flow of students going to the United States. Now, you might say, well, to the anti-immigration people, maybe that sounds good. But to the cashiers at the offices of the University of California campuses, this is a very scary prospect. So it's very, very interesting. So even right down to the campus level, it will be interesting to watch what will happen and what its impact will be in terms of cultural exchange and even in terms of cash exchange.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.